Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, or most of our regulars. Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Sitting in this week for Bill Galston is Philip Bump of the Washington Post. And our special guest is Pulitzer Prize winning author and contributor to The Atlantic, Ann Applebaum. Welcome one and all. We have a lot of news this week. Something really fairly momentous took place between the last time we met and now, namely the Congress passed and the president has signed, finally, aid for Ukraine and also some of our other allies, including Israel and Taiwan. So I'd like to begin with this, the meaning of it. Anne, you're very familiar with the Europeans and, of course, with the Ukrainians. Describe the effect on Ukraine and then more broadly on what this projects about America's role in the Western alliance.
So first of all, yes, of course, there will be an immediate impact in Ukraine. We may have already seen it, the arrival of U.S. long-range missiles, but also in the next few days, the arrival of ammunition supplies. The Ukrainians were beginning to lose territory. Russia did have the momentum on the ground, at least in eastern Ukraine. And hopefully this will begin to reverse that. Just as important is the psychological effect. So the reemergence of the United States as an important security ally of Ukraine and of Europe. Suddenly Russia is confronted with the fact that they want, you know, they're not going to walk over easily. They're not going to win this year. They're going to have a much higher bar to jump over than they expected. All of their messaging about the Ukraine cause being hopeless, about the U.S. being weak, about the alliance being broken, all of that now looks wrong. I mean, there was actually some amusing sputtering of Russian propagandists on television the last couple of days trying to explain this to their viewers, to whom they'd already explained many times that the United States was already out of the game and had been irrevocably weakened. And so reviving, you know, bringing back at least for the moment the idea that the U.S. can still be a world player and it still has a consistent commitment to peace and security in Europe is extremely important. I mean, of course, behind this, you know, is the question, what would happen if Trump won the election? The longer term prospect of an unstable United States remains with us and it remains of great worry to European allies, and not only. I mean, the America's Asian allies, so South Korea and Japan and Taiwan, were also watching this argument. Many others around the world were also watching it and as a kind of harbinger of what might be to come. And I'm not sure that we've reassured everybody.
Philip, one of the things that we saw during the past several weeks is members of the Republican Congress, leaders of important committees, saying publicly that members of their own conference were repeating Russian propaganda on the House floor. It is a fact that a majority of the Republican conference voted against this bill. First of all, say what you would like about the role of Russian disinformation and Russian propaganda here and the GOP.
I think that there's a blurry line here, right? There are arguments that are put forward by Russia that are potent and compelling to a section, particularly of the American right. I don't know that, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, sits down and, you know, tunes into to Russian television if there's some sort of translation and adopts rhetoric from there. I do think, though, that she is eager to embrace the idea that Ukraine is undemocratic, that Russia is not the aggressive actor that most American authorities understand. In part because she, like Donald Trump, is sympathetic to this authoritarian approach to things, and in part because she is a contrarian, and in part because Ukraine is now something that has been folded into partisanship, as so many other things have. So I do think it is the case that Russia puts forward these arguments that have been adopted and then echoed by people like Tucker Carlson, who's very early on this on Fox News, you know, picking up these false claims about biolabs and about how Russia, you know, was only acting in response to the expansion of NATO. Like, all those claims are claims that were advocated by Russia But then Tucker Carlson picks them up because he, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, has these impulses, right? So it is this sort of laundering system that I don't know is even necessarily intentional. I'm sure the Russians are very happy to do it, and Russians celebrate, you know, when Marjorie Taylor Greene does it and when Tucker Carlson does it. But then that effect is that it simply provides rhetoric that the Republicans seize upon because all they want to do is argue against it because they want to take the contrary position to the Democrats. And the Democratic position is, let's bolster Ukraine, let's provide them the assistance that they need in order to try and repel the Russians. And the Republican position on the fringe right, but a majority of the caucus, as we saw in the vote last weekend, is let's not do that.
Linda, let's talk about Mike Johnson. I didn't see this coming. That he chose to do the right thing. Back on April 1st, our friend Bill Kristol put out a newsletter saying, you know, giving the news of the day. And one of the first items on his April Fool's Day jokey newsletter was Mike Johnson announces that he's going to do the right thing and just push for a vote on Ukraine aid, hell with the MAGA people. And of course, that's pretty close to what happened. He did stare down the crazy caucus. He stared down a majority of his caucus. So first of all, we all are grateful to him for doing that, but he got Trump's imprimatur, right? He went down to Mar-a-Lago and Trump said, yeah, we have to back Mike Johnson. It's not in Trump's interest to have another vacate the chair moment and chaos in the Republican conference. So does Mike Johnson get a win here and not have to worry about being replaced?
Well, that remains to be seen. I do think that you're right, that Trump decided it was not in his interest to have another vacate the chair moment, as you suggest. And we talked about this last week, that even Marjorie Taylor Greene was not saying, well, absolutely, I'm going to introduce it and it's going to happen. Because she didn't know who was going to be next. And so I think that's true. But I think something else is at play here. And it's very important. And it sort of picks up on what Philip was saying and my somewhat disagreement with him. It is absolutely true that, you know, I don't think that the Russian embassy is sending couriers down to Capitol Hill with talking points for these members. That, you know, that's clear. That's not happening. But there is this echo chamber that has been created on social media and particularly on right-wing media. And let's just, you know, state a fact. These people, the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world, even the Mike Johnsons of the world, are not people who are reading, in-depth articles in substantial publications. They're not reading The Atlantic. They're not reading Foreign Policy. They're not reading Commentary Magazine, even. These are people who are picking up tidbits that they can then just regurgitate. What happened with Mike Johnson is when he became speaker, he started getting briefings that he had not been getting as simply a, you know, sort of not quite backbencher, but not a really prominent member of the leadership in the Republican House. And I think those briefings really sort of sobered him up. And I think it may be the first time that he started hearing from people that he could respect what actually is going on between Russia and Ukraine. And I think it had some effect. And I think we may be giving him too little credit for his having had a sharp learning curve here. But I think he is not as gullible today to the kind of echo chamber that exists on the right on this issue. Would that that could be true of more members of that wing.
Yeah, Damon, if we could kidnap and deprogram all of the Republicans in the House, that would be great. We could force them into a room and give them briefings and show them the light. But it wouldn't actually probably make a difference since their constituents are still getting Tucker Carlson's view of reality and Laura Ingraham's, et cetera. And so until we change that, we wouldn't necessarily change the behavior of the Republicans in Congress. But so last week we talked about this and we all agreed that the House is crazy, et cetera. But I want to drill down a little bit. I mean, this does look like a real loss for Marjorie Taylor Greene and company. And don't you think that can be kind of contagious, a sense that, look, you know, they are a paper tiger. You can stand up to them. And does this now diminish the threat that they've been holding, this tiny minority of members have been holding over the speaker, that will vote to vacate the chair, which only requires one member? Have they been defanged a little bit?
Well, I mean, I don't really know, because when you're dealing with, as you said, one member can do the vacate move, but we're also dealing with a margin between the parties, as I said last week, that is just so narrow that it only takes a couple of lunatics to send things off the rails. So things remain pretty precarious. The thing about the way this all finally culminated here in this last week that I think is very encouraging and interesting is that I think many of us here, myself certainly, who follow this stuff very closely, there's been uncertainty throughout all of it. How large of a faction of Republicans is it that support, we'll call it, even though Trump's position on this seems kind of peculiar and muddled and inconsistent in the way he often is, and he appears to have given a green light to Johnson to go forward with this, even though I was just going to say the Trumpist position would be the one that he articulated in the primaries of elect me president and I'll end the war in 24 hours, which means hand Ukraine to Putin. If that's his position, my question all along has been, well, how many Republicans really want that? And for now, at least, we actually have an answer. 112 Republicans in the House voted against this bill. That's almost exactly half. So that's pretty discouraging. On the other hand, it's only about half. And in the House, in the Senate, it's much more moderate and more reasonable. The rot is less deeply entrenched. And that's, I think, for reasons that Madison and Hamilton and the other framers of the Constitution would explain very patiently as, well, the Senate is less deeply connected to the electorate. And so there's, you know, they're only elected every 6 years and they represent entire states, whereas the House is much more frequently elected and they have small districts and they have been gerrymandered such that there are about 112 members of the House who come from districts where the people there get all of their information from this right-wing ecosystem and have now bought into it. So I actually, in the scheme of this world we live in now, post-2016, I am moderately encouraged to learn that it is only half of the Republican caucus in the House that is on board with this at this point. That is a sign of like, all right, most Democrats are in the right place on this. Half of Republicans, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That's a large portion of the country. It's a large portion of our representative institutions. And that gives me a little bit of hope that things maybe aren't quite as far gone as I feared. The last thing I'll say, as is my wont, we'll throw a little bit of a dark curve on this, is to go back once again to this issue about Johnson and what led him to switch on this. I mean, I'm very grateful that he did. I think it's great that he was open-minded enough to actually listen to the intelligence briefings rather than slam the door in the face of the briefer from the CIA on this, as some members would. But I just can't help but stand back and say, my God, where are we? Let me tell you, I do not receive intelligence briefings from the upper reaches of the federal government. I simply read. And so I know what's going on in the world. Americans who read regular newspapers know what's going on in the world. And yet that they're the Speaker of the House needed to receive a classified intelligence briefings or several of these briefings in order to be persuaded away from the complete nonsense that he was marinating in, along with 112 of his colleagues, or 100 and whatever, 100 or so of his colleagues, is a truly, really, like, chilling thought, because it means that they are completely cut off from any external source of information. And that's not a very encouraging thought for how the most powerful and important democracy in the world conducts its affairs in the world.
I think this really underestimates the scale of politics here. I think the reason that Johnson took the step he did wasn't because he got a briefing. It was because Marjorie Taylor Greene had already dropped the nuclear option, right? He was trying to figure out if there's a way to appeal to the fringe right of his caucus. Marjorie Taylor Greene said there's not. And he said, okay, to hell with that. I'm going to work with the Democrats, right? You know, it's not that they don't read this stuff. I'm sure they don't. But it's because the social media response they get is predicated on something else. And that's what they're responding to, right? We see Tom Massey posting this video from the floor of the House in which the Democrats are cheering with Ukraine flags. And that's used as a partisan signal to say, look how crazy the Democrats are, right? So, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, there absolutely is some ignorance rooted in the decision not to support this. But it's fundamentally politics. And it's politics. Marjorie Taylor Greene pushed Johnson to a position where he could do this. And I think that's probably the bigger factor.
And actually, he worked with Democrats, which is something that Kevin McCarthy would not do. And he's still standing and McCarthy's out. All right. But so in line with what Damon was saying about some of the crazier people on the right, you've got J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley and people like that really repeating talking points from Russian propaganda. So I'd like you to respond to one or two of these ideas that have penetrated very deeply on the right. One of them is that, and I think actually one of the people that Mike Johnson heard from was a pastor from Ukraine who disabused him of the idea that the Ukrainian regime is anti-Christian. So that's one of them, is this whole anti-Christian theme. And the other is the idea J.D. Vance pushes, which is it's crazy to think Russia has four times as many troops as Ukraine. Obviously, they're going to win. So we have to cede territory and, you know, sue for peace. So respond to both of those.
I'll respond to them, first of all, by saying that it is a well thought through and organized echo chamber. It's not that these Republicans are randomly picking stuff up. What the Russians have created is an overall overarching narrative about the superiority of autocracy, the weakness and division of democracies, the inevitable victory of dictatorship. And they put it out in different ways. They're also, by the way, now echoed by the Chinese and sometimes even the Iranians. If you hold that thought for a couple more weeks, there's an Atlantic cover story coming out about exactly this, which I wrote. So I'll explain this in more detail. Some of this comes through overt Russian channels. Some of it comes through what's called information laundering. So outlets or people or organization that look like something else that may in fact be Russian or may in fact be Russian influenced. There's a lot of thought and a lot of money that goes into it. So it's not accidental. It's a carefully constructed campaign, essentially. And yes, you're right. One of the more absurd arguments in the campaign was this one about the Ukrainians somehow repressing Christians. I mean, look, Russia has been repressing evangelicals since the 1930s. So I wrote a book about the Soviet concentration camps, and there's a part in it about the evangelicals of different kinds, Protestants of different kinds, Jehovah's Witnesses, all kinds of people who ended up in Soviet concentration camps because the Russian state has always perceived Protestants in particular of all kinds as being somehow foreign or alien and therefore enemies of the state and enemies of the people. That has not changed in Putin's Russia, and it's particularly acute and unpleasant in the occupied territories of Ukraine. So where Russia has occupied Ukraine, you have massive religious repression. Also, I should say of Catholics. Catholics are also now identified as anti-Russian or Western, and there is a very large and important part of the Catholic Church, especially Ukrainian part of the Catholic Church in Ukraine as well. So this was a completely absurd, upside-down idea that Ukraine represses Christians. And the fact that some members of the Republican Party are repeating, as I said, it's not an accident. I mean, it was, you know, it's been fed into the echo chambers that they listen to. It's been passed on. And again, it's part of this narrative about democracy being anti-Christian and Joe Biden being anti-Christian and the left taking over and so on. I mean, it fits into other pieces of the story that are told in other ways. And so, yes, that's absurd. The J.D. Vance argument is more insidious and in some ways uglier because, of course, why is Ukraine outgunned by Russia? Why do they have so much less ammunition than Russia? It's because we're not helping them. And so the idea that, you know, we have to give up because the Ukrainians are losing and they're not losing because they have less ammunition, because we're not giving them ammunition, is a profoundly disingenuous argument. It's also the argument that Vance and others make is also a strange one, because it doesn't account for what the cost would be for Ukraine to lose. And remember, Putin is not fighting this war for territory. He doesn't need more land. He doesn't want to exchange land for peace or whatever formula it is that we have. You know, there's not right now, there's not a deal that we can do with him where, I don't know, we give him Donetsk and he stops fighting. He could have done that 10 years ago. You know, so he's, that's not the point of the war. The point of the war, from his point of view, is to destroy all of Ukraine, to make it unviable, to eliminate it as a state, preferably to murder Zelensky, to replace him with a pro-Russian leader, or simply to take over Kiev and run it as a Russian province. So that's actually the goal. So, and if you allow that to happen, if that's what Vance's argument is, then you have millions of Ukrainian refugees, then you have a re-empowered Russian army on NATO's borders, then you have consequences for the rest of the world. You know, that China would have seen that it's possible to defeat all of the Western powers, the United States plus Europe and Ukraine. You would have consequences in the Middle East. You would have consequences everywhere. So the cost of letting Russia win, of giving up, is unbelievably high, and much higher than the cost of the foreign aid bill that we've just passed. But nevertheless, as I said, the narrative of failure, you know, we can't win, it's impossible, you know, our society is weak. This is deeply connected to a larger overarching, you know, autocratic narrative that the Russians have spent years and years and years constructing, and that a part of the U.S. public, mostly on the far right and a little bit on the far left, have also bought into.
Yeah, this disinformation technique is something that they have perfected over not just, you know, the last several years, but over decades and even arguably centuries, going back to the Tsars. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a Tsarist forgery. They have been at this for a very, very long time. And we on the right used to mock people on the left for falling for obvious Soviet propaganda. And they did the same thing then. They would launder it through, you know, some front group that didn't seem to be coming from them, but it did originate from the KGB. They haven't lost the knack, right?
No, I mean it's actually much more sophisticated now than it used to be. And as I said, they're now working in concert with others. I mean, they have partners in China, they have partners in Iran, they have partners in other parts of the world who are selling the same messages. And they're, of course, they're now, you know, this more detailed than you want to know. I mean, there are now all kinds of ways where you can launch a message on social media. You can then delete the original account that launched it, but then you can use your proxies and your friends to spread it anyway. I mean, there are a lot of tactics and techniques that now go into information laundering. You know, again, I don't want to say though that Americans are somehow helpless victims, and you know, Americans are part of this. I mean, there's a big American network that is also believes in promoting the idea of autocracy over democracy, and that also believes in telling Americans that they're weak and helpless and divided, and we need some kind of, you know, we need a completely different kind of government to run our country. That's the game that J.D. Vance is playing. So there are plenty of Americans doing this too, but the, you know, the effect is to amplify and to push these Russian narratives, which are sometimes profoundly untrue, like the one about Christians.
Thank you. All right. Let's have a word from Miracle Made. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend that you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, they use silver-infused fabrics to make temperature-regulated bedding. You can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. I know I go to bed cold and I wake up in the middle of the night hot, throw off the blankets. Well, these sheets are self-regulating. They are also self-cleaning. Because of the silver that is infused, it prevents 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them cleaner and fresher than other sheets. Miracle Made sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands, and they feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels. So stop sleeping on bacteria. and stay clean with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to get your Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. If you use our promo, BEGTODIFFER, at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save even more. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer and use the code BEGTODIFFER. All right. All right. Want to thank Anne Applebaum for joining us. She had to jump off, but we're going to continue now with discussion about what's happening on American college campuses. It began, unfortunately, at my alma mater, Columbia, which seems to be most famous for not great scholarship, but student protests. That's what they seem to excel at there. Actually, I'm exaggerating. But anyway, it did start at Columbia, but it's now all over the country. University of Ohio, UT in Texas, Yale, NYU, Berkeley, of course, etc. So students are staging sit-ins. They are creating encampments, which was why eventually the president of Columbia called in the New York City police, because they wouldn't take down this encampment, and they were playing drums and loud music all the time and disturbing other students, and they wouldn't disband. And now there are, you know, accusations flying every which way. God bless anybody who would try to be a university president these days, because they get it from both ends, right? They have Republicans saying you should fire any professor who is, you know, saying things that are incendiary, and then and that you should resign if you're not protecting Jewish students. And then you have your faculty and your students who are going to be very upset with you if you do anything to protect the Jewish students and make them feel at home. Anyway, Columbia this week had to take all its classes online because the Jewish students were feeling so endangered. Now, I'm going to start with you, Linda. It's important to make certain distinctions here, because we live in an era when a lot of people claim that they feel unsafe when they hear views they don't agree with. You had this, I think, most famously in the case of the New York Times journalists who objected to the op-ed that was run by Senator Tom Cotton saying that we should call in the military to deal with rioters. And a number of journalists at the paper said this made them feel unsafe, which is a huge expansion of, you know, it's they call it safetyism. What it really means is I want to shut down views that I don't agree with. That's not what we're seeing here. We're seeing, I mean, there may be some of that, but we're also seeing genuine threats. So what's your sense of it?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, student protests, I don't know, as long as there are students, there will be protests. This is nothing new. And given what's going on politically right now, it's not terribly surprising to see that this is infecting campuses. What does seem to be at play here, though, is something that is very dangerous. And that is that groups of students and non-students, because a lot of the people who were in these encampments would be what we used to call in the bad old days of the 60s, outside agitators.
Actually, people, Mayor Adams did call them,
yes,
that.
Yes, outside agitators, right.
He did.
So, but they are actually threatening other students. And it's not a question of a policy debate. It's not even a question about should the United States be funding Israel? Should American weapons be being used in Gaza? Those are debates that you could have on campus and have lively discussions about. But these are people who are actually making anti-Semitic threats at students. Not allowing, obviously, Jewish students. I think there were some pictures, I think they were from Yale, but I may be wrong about that, of a student who was dressed in sort of traditional Hasidic garb, you know, earlocks, hat, etc. essentially being locked out, not being allowed to go into a building or to get across campus, wherever it is he was trying to go. There are people holding signs that saying, you know, you're going to be the next victim, essentially. People calling for death, people celebrating terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. And then you cross the space from normal kinds of protests where you are allowed to speak your mind into the area of actually clear and present danger to other people. And I think that's what Columbia is contending with. It's what Yale is contending with, schools in California. It really is spreading throughout the country. And it is a very dangerous phenomena. And it's not as if we don't have a history of these kinds of threats being acted upon. And certainly with respect to anti-Semitism, we have centuries-long persecution of the Jews. So this really is serious. It has to stop. The question is how you go about doing that. Do you go in and, as they are now, you know, forcing the Columbia encampment to be dismantled? Are we going to see the kind of clashes we saw in the 60s between protesters and the police? And it's a very, you know, it's a very worrisome outcome.
Phil, some people make the point that there's a lot of hypocrisy here, that it is true that you want people to be able to speak their minds, and people who have strong feelings about Gaza and so forth should be able to protest, should be able to express themselves. And yet they say, imagine if the target of some of these protesters were different. Imagine if it were racists protesting and pointing signs at Black students saying, global intifada is one of the phrases, or, you know, hope that this is the KKK's next victim pointing at a Black student. Do we think for a minute that the campuses would, you know, would say, well, free speech?
This is a complicated question for a lot of reasons. And I don't mean your question specifically, but I mean the broader question here, right?
Yeah.
I think it is clearly the case that different people react to different sorts of implied threats than others, that different statements that might be made would have different effects, right? I do think that one of the things that gets lost here, or one of the things that happens here, is this conflation between the people who are making specific, obviously threatening and obviously unacceptable, I guess you could say, although that's fraught when we're talking about the First Amendment free speech, when people are making threatening comments, separating that out from the protesters who are engaged in this encampment because they are encouraging, say, divestment on the behalf of their universities, right? And so that's the line, I think, that gets extremely blurry, and that there is a lot of willingness to blur that line on both sides to some extent, because it is easier to call for state police in Texas or the New York police in Manhattan to come in if the impression is that everyone who's doing this is behaving in the same way, which I just think is categorically not the case. And so that's the challenge. What do you do if you have people who are saying the things, regardless of what they're saying, you know, to your point, Mona, or to your point, Linda, if people are saying these things that are broadly considered reprehensible, and to the point that people feel threatened by them, which again, which itself is a blurry line, right? The difference between feeling threatened and being threatened. You know, if there is this mixing all this together, you know, at what point do you call the police? At what point is it appropriate to sweep all of them out if some of them are doing this thing? And there's no answer to that. There's no good answer to that, right? That advocates say, you don't, and you allow them to police themselves and to remove those agitators. But then maybe there's a disinterest in removing those agitators, or maybe the agitators are not seen in the same way by the people who are doing the sort of generally agreed upon okay protesting around divestiture or whatever it happens to be, that they don't see them as threatening in the same way, right? So this is all extremely fraught. And one of the reasons that the First Amendment exists is because it cuts through all this, right? It slices the Gordian knot in saying that you are allowed to say things, that the government cannot crack down on you for saying things, and that the perception of threat has always been a challenging issue for the First Amendment, right? you know, we point to the screaming fire in a crowded theater, which of course is an inaccurate counterpoint to First Amendment arguments. But it is a good example of the sorts of things where we get into that gray area. I think the challenge in the moment is in part that this crackdown that we're seeing, which I understand why there are advocates for it, I think it's heavy-handed in most cases, that the crackdown that we're seeing risks simply encouraging young people to get involved more so, right? We see this pattern historically with protests where the having the protests be seen as anti-establishment by itself fosters, you know, sympathy for the protesters. And so I think all of this will conclude in relatively short order. I mean, Columbia is done with classes in what I think next week, a week after that, at which point, you know, I think this dissipates. But I think in this moment, we're in this really weird space of negotiating in real time a lot of First Amendment issues with really severe repercussions, both for those who are affected by the speech patterns that they find concerning and for those on the ground who are face to face with riot cops.
So, Damon, in First Amendment law, it is understood that while we have very, very broad free expression rights in this country, states can impose time, place, and manner restrictions on speech. So you do have the right to say Joe Biden is a criminal, but you don't have the right to scream it outside my window at 3 a.m. So in these campus situations, it seems to me that like Greg Abbott in Texas called in the police to shut down a protest that was in an area that is specifically like meant for having demonstrations and protests and was not violating the rules. Whereas you could make the argument that in Columbia's case, you know, these protests, they were engaged in civil disobedience. They knew they were violating the rules. They had opportunities to express themselves, but they were carrying on all night and making it hard for other students to sleep, to study for exams, to write their papers, etc. And so when it comes to that, like when you commit civil disobedience, you have to be willing to accept the consequences. And that means, like Martin Luther King, you get arrested and then you go to jail to show this is an unjust law or whatever, or I'm making my point. You know, what these students are saying is we don't recognize any limitations and that our rights are absolute.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there is a sense among the young protesters who, you know, who have never done this before, most of them, because they're young people, and their only awareness of this kind of thing is in seeing newsreel footage from the late 60s or early 70s, and it's all kind of lionized and romanticized. And so they sort of expect the world to like bow down and say, oh, great, very moral young person, please tell me your wisdom. There's this general feeling, and this is cultivated by some professors on the left. I am not one of them.
By the way, what's it like at Penn? Do you have protests?
Penn
there?
Is very quiet right now. Okay. It was quite raucous last fall in the you know, the couple of months between October 7th and the end of the semester. Things got a little hairy here for a while, and there was a lot of controversy on campus. It brought down our president. In fact, after right. her testimony in Congress. But this semester, thankfully, has been pretty quiet. There's nothing really going on here. You know, if it were March and all of this were happening with the kind of demonstration effects we're seeing from Columbia spreading elsewhere, maybe that wouldn't be true. But, you know, we are coming to the end of classes next week and finals are coming up. So I think we've dodged the protest bullet here this semester. But I have to say that, I mean, I don't have really strong views on all of this. I do agree these protests happen at college campuses. It's good not to overreact against them. I think sometimes the protesters go too far. Sometimes grandstanding right-wing politicians like Greg Abbott go too far in the other direction. And then, of course, we also live in an era of freelance propagandists. And in the case of Columbia in particular, where I have some friends on the faculty, I know that we, as Philip and Linda and you, Mona, I think all mentioned in different ways, the Columbia protests were happening in kind of two buckets. You had the ones that are on the closed campus in a corner of the main lawn. And sometimes those get out of hand and they get too loud and they disrupt classes and make certain students feel unsafe. But they're in kind of a different category than the ones you keep seeing on social media, where it looks like, I don't know, we're in the middle of like some kind of anarchist revolt of people screaming extremely incendiary things and seem on the verge of violence, blocking gates. Well, that's the gate to the campus. And so one main reason why they've had to go to Zoom for holding classes this last week is not so much that the closed campus itself isn't able to hold classes. It's that if you live off campus, you have to get to the campus and get through those gates. And the gates have become magnets for a bunch of radicals and weirdos from all over the New York area who have converged there so they can get on camera and be seen and heard. And of course, the far left and then some on the more extreme pro-Israel right kind of all have an incentive to advance their agenda by making these videos, editing them, sometimes a little deceptively, putting them out on social media with their spin on it. So when I said at the beginning, I don't have strong opinions on this, I mean that in a kind of almost medicinal way, in the sense that like, we are being revved up and whipped up so much by the different forces around these things that I think it's best to try to keep our heads and not kind of fall into the kind of echo chamber of extremism on those sides. So in general, I think, again, we have to allow these things to happen. Some do go too far, but it's also not a good idea to follow Tom Cotton and send in the troops, as it were. The last thing I just want to add very briefly at the end is the thing that does worry me about this far more than what's happening now is all of this as a kind of dry run at the Democratic convention.
Yeah.
That is where we have to be worried that this, you want to see 68 Redux. Where is it? Oh, it's in Chicago. What an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
Like that is what I really am worried about, that all this energy on the left that is really whipped up in a way that does resemble a lot of what was going on in 68, which again, then was a mixture of legitimate anger with sort of, you know, global South, very extreme new left arguments. And there's the 2024 version of that today. And if that all descends on Chicago and we end up repeating what we've seen at the gates of Columbia this week, magnified in a much larger way, that could be very, very bad for Joe Biden and the Democrats. And you have no doubt that the right wants to see that happen, and some on the left also want to see that happen. So there's yet another reason to pray for peace in the Middle East.
Note to protesters, there's another convention this summer in Milwaukee.
Yeah, not far away.
Not far away. All right, let's have a word now from our friends at Factor. My husband loves these meals, so he swears by them. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular ones like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also consider more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. No fuss, no muss meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. It's tailored to your schedule, and you can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/begtodiffer50 and use the code BEGTODIFFER50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off the next one. That's code BEGTODIFFER50 at factormeals.com. All right. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today regarding Trump's claim of immunity. I don't want to spend too much time on this now because it's a really, really complicated subject and we don't have time to get deeply into it. So I'm just going to ask everybody to give their top line takeaway insight from the oral argument, starting with you, Philip Bump.
Yeah, and I'm actually writing a piece about this. I thought it was really interesting when Justice Sotomayor challenged Trump's attorney Sawyer by asking him if it was the case that a president could ask the military to engage in a coup and be immune from prosecution. And the reason I thought that was interesting was because that question, more than a lot of the hypotheticals that were presented, really got to the point of why they were all there, which is that Donald Trump is accused in the D.C. court of having tried to block his successor, and that the fact that they were having that hearing at all was an indication that presidents already have systems to avoid accountability for doing things like that, because the conservative-led Supreme Court decided in February, okay, yes, we're going to hear this, which they could have rejected out of hand. Then they waited 2 months to actually have the hearing, and they helped push it out so that it may not even come to a trial before the election itself. And so it was not only an interesting question to challenge the merits of the argument, which I think the merits of the argument are extremely dubious, but it was also a reflection of the reality of both the case at hand and the ways in which Donald Trump had already avoided that sort of accountability.
Damon.
As the resident skeptic of the legal path to ridding us of Donald Trump, I will only say we have an election coming up and let's beat him. all of this legal stuff, I'm not surprised. I may be a little surprised that as many of the right-leaning justices seemed open to some of these immunity arguments that to me seem completely nuts. Like alone among democracies, America has an executive who really is above the law. What? How could that possibly be right?
The America that broke off from England to get out from under a king.
Right, exactly. So like in all kinds of ways, we don't have a king, but, you know, we also have an absolutist ruler who actually, if the president does it, it's not wrong. It's not illegal. Trump pushes things to the absolute limit, the threshold of what's permissible in politics, what is legal and not legal, right to the edge. And those edge cases are hard to adjudicate. And so what that means is that if we're going to pursue trying to get him legally, it's not going to be quick. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be decisive. It's going to mean appeals, courts, appealing things. Nuanced distinctions have to be made. It's going to get kicked down to other courts. It's going to have to be relitigated. And, you know, fine if we need to do it because he's done these things and there's no other way to get him on the legal front, fine. But we can't assume it's going to get resolved before the election. It would have been nice if we were going to do this and, the attorney general had started the wheels in motion a year earlier, then maybe that would have been a little different. But the basic problem was still going to be there that, this is complicated stuff. We're dealing with edge cases and edge cases make bad law.
Linda, I've been amazed that so much of the commentary and the exhortations, I think Liz Cheney had a piece in the New York Times, and others have been urging the court to not find that Trump has immunity so that we can get this case going again, the Chutkan case in Washington. I was surprised, frankly, by these arguments because I felt as soon as the Supreme Court granted cert, that the chances that that case would ever come to trial went right down the drain. Because, it would just, even if they made a decision and it came out next week, it's still probably not enough time to try this case. But having listened to the oral argument today, I am now like 99% certain that this cannot come to trial before November because five four certainly, and maybe five of the justices seem to think that Trump does have a colorable claim to at least some immunity in some situations, and they're probably going to remand to have the court, the trial court, decide which acts were official and which were private, and et cetera. So it seems to me that we already know what the practical outcome of this case will be vis-a-vis Trump's trial. We don't know what the legal outcome will be yet in terms of what they rule about presidential immunity.
Well, I heard it a little differently than you did, Amona. I absolutely agree that this notion that we were going to get a 9-0 decision, and it was going to be that Trump, like every other person who is an American citizen, is not above the law and therefore move ahead. That was never going to happen. However, one of the things that I found most surprising and interesting in this, because I really had not heard him say it before, is Trump's lawyer, Mr. Sawyer, basically conceded that some of the things that Trump is being accused of doing mm-hmm. were definitely private acts, that when you're consulting with your campaign advisors and you've got private lawyers and you're deciding to put together a group of fake electors,
yeah.
that's a private action. Well, that's part of what he's being charged with. So, hey, guys, let's move ahead with that part. The thing that bothered me most, and it bothered me as a conservative. As a conservative, one of the things that I always learned was that when you have a case before the court, you don't decide future cases, hypotheticals, that you deal with the facts of the case before you and you rule in such a way that you rule on the case. And what the people like Alito and to some extent Clarence Thomas, though he was not as active as Alito was, were arguing is we have got to decide now what are official acts and what kinds of official acts are going to be immune from future criminal prosecution. No, you don't. You don't have to decide that at all. You could remand back to the district court for the court to have a hearing. Doesn't have to be, it isn't the trial, so that could happen right away, and try to determine what in the charging document might, you could make an argument, were official acts and which were not. And even for those that Trump would argue were official acts, I think the prosecutors could make a case that they were not. So I do think that we could see some action on this. It may be remanded back to the district court to make that distinction between official and private acts. But at least with respect to a big portion of what Trump was charged with, having to do with his fake elector scheme, et cetera, and even talking to his vice president about what he should or should not do, that there is no way that that could be viewed as an official act. So I was a little more optimistic than you, and I could actually see it coming down 7-2 with some movement on this case.
Okay. Well, we will see. Let's turn now to our final segment, which we're going to do something a little different this week. Instead of highlight or lowlight of the week, I noticed this story about the Voyager spacecraft. So this thing was launched into space when I was a young adult, like 20. And I remember being really interested in this because the idea of the Voyager spacecraft was to send it all the way to the edge of our solar system to teach us more about the planets, but also to keep going after it exited, you know, after it left the path of the last planet, to keep going. And therefore, the idea was at some point, maybe this probe will make contact with other civilizations in the universe. And so they put on, there were actually two Voyagers, but anyway, they put on these little golden records that are both audio and video with, of course, 20th century technology. They could be a lot better now. But with the guidance of Carl Sagan and some others, they decided what to put on it. And they put on, you know, greetings in like something like 55 languages of the earth. They put down whale sounds and baby crying and waves breaking on a shore and the music of Mozart and, Chuck Berry and various other things. So that's what's out there. And I wanted each of you to weigh in with, if you were going to send out to some unknown possible alien civilization that might encounter us, something that would represent the best of what we are, what would it be? So, Damon Linker, what you got?
Now, is the idea I'm supposed to name one thing or
no, it doesn't have to be just one.
I mean,
thing.
Obviously the greatest holy texts of all the major world religions I would put in there. So the Hebrew and Christian Bibles, Quran, the holy texts of Buddhism and Hinduism. I think Plato's Republic is, in my view, the greatest work of philosophy ever written. So I would throw that in the bucket. And I'm a huge fan of music. And so Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and the Beatles, a little clip of each of those four, I think would be lovely. And I could go on and on and on because I'm a booster of humanism, but I will leave room for others so people don't say I snatched their selections from underneath. Okay. So that's my choice.
Thank you. Those are good. Okay, Linda.
Well, I will tell you, I'm not a sci-fi fan, so this is a little unusual, but this week I watched Netflix series Three Body Problem, which is a science fiction tale, a Chinese tale. I watched it mostly because their cultural revolution, a Mao's cultural revolution, played a part. But something it taught me, which is very important, is be careful what you communicate to extraterrestrial beings out there who may be of higher intelligence. It could turn out very badly. So in doing that, that guided my picks here. I've decided not to include any texts, nothing that could cause problems. So I picked four things that I would include. One is because I think they could be perceived by any kind of being. You don't need language. So they were two sculptures, Aphrodite's on Cnidus, Praxiteles, I think is how you say his name, is a 4th century BC figure of a human female body, naked, beautiful piece. And with that, David's by Michelangelo's David would be the counterpart. And then two pieces of music, because music is in many ways universal. And I picked two that express the range of human emotion. One, an obvious one, Ode to Joy by Beethoven. And the second one, not so obvious, by one of my favorite 20th century composers, Henryk Gorecki, Symphony No. 3, which is also called the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, which is, I think, the most beautiful thing written in the 20th century. So those are my four contributions.
Excellent. Thank you. Philip Bump.
So I was a philosophy major in college. So that's the predicate for this going sideways very quickly. But, you know, instantly my thought was, well, why are we assuming that these alien species have any sense of what they're doing? I mean, the nice thing about the record is you can actually run a needle on it. And you can hear sounds emerge from it. So then maybe they can figure that out. But I just sort of set aside that whole idea of context and comprehension and just assuming that somehow they've managed this. I had two thoughts, neither of which is terribly satisfying in the way that my colleagues here have presented of, you know, representing the best of humanity. But I think the spacecraft itself is a very good vessel in two senses of the word. It is a demonstration of technological accomplishment. It contains its own recognition of the importance of itself as a vessel. And I think that is a very good encapsulation of where we are. But the other thing I thought of, that again, setting aside all issues of comprehension, is a haiku from Isa, a Japanese poet, which has stuck with me for a very, very long time. And I think encapsulates a lot about humanity in an abstract sense. So I'm, you know, again, assuming that this level of abstraction, and it is very simply, oh, do not swat them, little flies, forever wringing thin hands, which is, I think, a really terrific poem and a good lens into how people see beauty in average things, which I think encompasses the human condition.
Nice. Okay. Well, those are all great. Mine would be to show images of human love. I would show parents interacting with their six-month-old baby and the joy and the smiles on all sides. And I would show a dog reacting to being reunited with its owner after a lengthy privation. And then I would also show human beings taking care of other human beings who are handicapped and send the signal that this is the best of us. We take care of those who cannot care for themselves. That's part of what our species does. And we have compassion. And so that's what I would hope to communicate. If the aliens are at all humanitarian, if you will, if you'll forgive the expression, they'll appreciate it. And if not, who cares? All right. Well, thank you all for that. Thanks, Philip, for filling in this week. It's always a joy to have you. And again, thanks to Ann Applebaum, of course, to my regulars, and our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary, and our wonderful viewers and listeners. And we will return next week, as every week.